Good morning, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. This is Spectrum West, the music, the arts, the culture of Wisconsin's left coast. I'm Al Ross, and today it's the music and the theories of Babatunde Lee, a multi-percussionist who gets around and has chosen to teach a drum camp at the Phipp Center for the Arts in Hudson. We'll hear his band and talk about the power of music as he feels it. Jim Oliver welcomes Jim Mandelair, board member of the Chippewa Falls Museum of Industry and Technology, all about the process and the premiere. It's a documentary film about the Cray influence, as in Cray research. The premiere is Monday at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls. Jill Ulm teaches art at UWEC. She also makes it, the abstract kind, for the last several years, and it gets noticed. Her work is part of a current exhibit at the Watrous Gallery in the Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters in Madison. We'll share some dialogue. And let's christen this voyage of the good ship Spectrum with this. Hunt Hill is a nature preserve near Sirona, Wisconsin. It's fast becoming a place to rely on for educational, enjoyable programs for young and old. We'll find out where it got its name, other historical factors, and how to take advantage of all it has to offer within a conversation I shared with program director Nikki Nelson, who began with a bit of her background and how she got so involved.
My background, I'm from the Cameron area and had gone to school at UW-Eau Claire for biology education and taught in the schools for a little while, and then decided I preferred getting kids outside to teach them about science than being in a classroom. So it just so happened that they had an opening here at Hunt Hill, and so I applied and was lucky enough to get it. And now as program director, I work with our volunteer board of directors, specifically the volunteer program committee, to develop the different programs that we offer here. The program committee helps to determine what the schedule will be for the year, and then I coordinate the schedules for all of our specialty speakers that come in, as well as work with our different educators who work right here on site with our school groups and summer programs.
Yeah, that's
it's a lot
neat.
Of fun.
Yeah, well, and since you were involved in biology, you, of course, were very familiar with the name Audubon, huh?
Yes, and that's kind of a special relationship anyway. You know, Hunt Hill is now its own entity, run by our volunteer board of directors known as the Friends of Hunt Hill Audubon Sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a little history on Hunt Hill is in the 50s, the land was donated to the Audubon Society. And in 55, it was opened as the Audubon Camp of Wisconsin. And it was kind of run as this very exclusive nature location where people would come from all over the U.S. to spend anywhere from a week to a couple weeks here studying the flora and fauna of the area. And in the 80s, they saw enrollment drop off so much that the Audubon Society actually considered closing down the camp and potentially selling it off. And a group of people, primarily people from the Twin Cities area who had really fallen in love with Hunt Hill, didn't want to see that happen. So they started a nonprofit group known as the Friends and went to Audubon Society and said, is there any way, if we follow the wishes of the donor, that we could keep Hunt Hill alive? And Audubon actually agreed with that. So the Audubon Society gives the Friends a free lease of the land. And then the Friends actually run and operate the whole camp. You know, when people are members of Audubon, they're actually a member of the Audubon Society. But if they want to support Hunt Hill, then they would become Hunt Hill members because Audubon doesn't support us financially at all.
Okay. We're taking up a little bit of the day of Nikki Nelson. She's the program director at Hunt Hill Audubon Sanctuary, and that is in,
I was just going to say in Sirona, Wisconsin.
That's right, Sirona. And I was going to say, depending on where you live and where you're listening, it is either down, up, or over in Sirona. Most people have just usually passed Sirona on 53. Sirona, pretty cool.
Sirona's a pretty tiny town, so it's kind of easy to miss. Not too much going on right there, but we do have so many beautiful lakes, cool areas to check out with different resorts and restaurants and lots of awesome things to do outdoors.
Mm-hmm. Was I right? You pass it on the four-lane highway, right? 53?
Yep, you do. Right in between Spooner and Wright Lake.
Yeah. Now, tell me about the name, Hunt Hill. Is there a hill that's a Hunt Hill, or was this a person, or what's the deal?
the reason that we have our name Hunch Hill, the landowner, there was actually the Andrews family, and they were grain merchants from the Twin Cities area, mm-hmm. and they had land all over. They have some land on Isle Royale, and they have some up in the Boundary Waters. The reason that they called this place Hunch Hill, they had two cabins that sat up on top of the hill. The mother's maiden name was Hunt. So when they would come to this piece of land, they would refer to it as Hunt Hill.
And maybe did a little hunting while they were there.
They might have. Today we don't do any hunting. We're actually a sanctuary. So then all living things are protected here.
Yeah, I like sanctuaries. You are a very active venue. Let's talk about some of the things you have because, you know, you are also very prolific in sending out releases, which all of us in the media like. You have the Cakes at the Lake stuff going on. You have live music at different places. You sent me a list of some things that are going on, like free busing and day camps. Why don't you tell us some of what's going on this summer?
We're pretty busy. We have, during the summer, Monday through Friday, just about every week of the summer, we have different day camp programs. Day camps are open to 5 to 12-year-olds, and each day features a different topic. They're usually nature-based, so things like frogs and salamanders or survival. We have a scaly situation. One new camp that we have this year is Hunt Hill's Hunger Games. So that could be pretty interesting.
Hopefully
everybody survives, though.
So
we have those each day of day camp features. The mornings have learning activities based on the topic. And then the afternoons, we do games and swimming and crafts. And then the fun part is at the end of each day, the parents or grandparents or whoever shows up, and we do a short little song or skit as kind of a closing to each day of camp.
You have adult stuff going on. You have a Spanish immersion program coming up, too.
Yes, our Spanish immersion has been going on for, I want to say, somewhere around 20 years.
Wow.
And this year, it runs July 28th through August 2nd. And it's a really fun time. Most of our educators for that are native Spanish-speaking educators. And so everybody comes and stays right on site. We do have overnight accommodations, and we have a dining hall, too. So they stay right here, and then we do Spanish language lessons during the day. And then at night, we do different cultural programs.
Cool.
On top of all that, we're here at the Nature Center. So then during free time, we offer, you know, nature hikes and canoeing and pontooning, mm-hmm. Things like that. And part of the reason for offering Spanish camp here is the donor of the property had a strong interest in cultural appreciation and understanding. So in addition to a strong love for nature, she also had asked whenever possible that we help explore different cultures.
Mm-hmm. And I did bring up the fact that you had, for those day camps, you had free busing coming from Hayward and Rice Lake and Spooner.
Yes, on Wednesdays, Community Bank of Northern Wisconsin has actually sponsored busing from Rice Lake and Spooner.
Mm-hmm.
Hayward Walmart sponsored busing for Hayward area kids on July 16th and August 6th.
Now, you mentioned the Friends of Hunt Hill, the very active and committed board. They're in the process of possibly expanding your property a little bit. Tell me about that. I mean, you have a dream for a formal nature center someday, don't you?
Yes. You know, what's really awesome about Hunt Hill is we're the sanctuary, and a lot of our property is state natural area, which means it, you know, can't be built on and will always be preserved.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that, then that kind of limits any sort of growth if we would want to do that building-wise. So we had a neighbor who was a wonderful lady, and she came to a lot of programs. She sadly passed away at Christmas time, and so her son has been working with us to sell the property right across from our property. So then that way we can protect close to 80 acres worth of land. It has field and forest. It has some creeks going along the edge of it as well. So our plan is first and foremost to protect that property, but then secondly, the potential of someday hopefully having a spot to build a nature center if we ever decided to. Right now, our facility, we have a lot of spaces that kind of flex to do whatever we need them to, but the hope would be to someday have that nature center
mm-hmm.
As a more formal location for people to come and visit. Right now, it's very exciting. Our goal to raise the money for the property is $195,000, and We have around $154,000 raised already, and that's donors who appreciate what we're doing. And so it's very exciting that that's all been support from our community and people who have fell in love with Hunt Hill.
Well, best of luck in realizing that dream. Now, one final bit of information we need to find out how to get to where you are, and we need to discover how to access you. Tell us how to contact you.
People can call anytime. Our phone number is 715-635-6543. Otherwise, the easiest way to get the most information is to go to hunthill.org.
Now, physically, can people just drive in and stop in and say hi or not?
Yes. You know, we really appreciate member support because that's one of our main ways of helping us out as a nature center. But you don't have to be a member to come to Hunt Hill.
Mm-hmm.
So we are open to the public, and people are always welcome to stop in anytime. We have about 10 miles worth of hiking trails that go through different habitats from prairie to bog along our lake shore through the forest. So people are always welcome to just stop in and see us or grab a trail map from one of our information kiosks and hike around.
And so if they're on Highway 53, how do they get to where you are?
From Highway 53, there's white arrow signs that kind of direct you along the way.
Oh, okay.
That's probably the easiest way. There's a few turns and corners depending on what direction you're coming from. But the easiest way is to just take Highway 53 onto Highway B as in boy, east on that road.
Mm-hmm.
And you go all the way until you get to a four-way stop. And then you go south onto Highway M as in man, 2 miles, and then take a right onto Audubon Road, and we're just a mile down Audubon Road.
Cool, you have your own road.
Yeah,
wow,
two roads.
You are important stuff. Nikki Nelson, Program Director, Hunt Hill Audubon Sanctuary in Sirona. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
That was a lot of fun. Again, the website is hunthill.org. Support for WPR comes from Visit Winona, home of the Great River Shakespeare Festival, June 28th through August 4th this year, performing King Henry V, Twelfth Night, and Macbeth. Visit Winona.com. This is the year to discover Winona's outdoors.
Support also comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making grocery shopping easier for all shoppers with the introduction of pink, yellow, and green boomerang buy tags throughout the store. Festival Foods, a Wisconsin-grown company.
Support also comes from Simply Done in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery in a local and fair trade gallery. Details at simply-dunn.com.
Spectra West on a Thursday morning, the 18th day of July. Thanks for being with us today. Jim Oliver's here with something a little off the beaten path for him. Jim normally brings us stories of literary nature or theatrical endeavors. This is about a film, a documentary, about an industry giant in a relatively small Wisconsin town.
The documentary film, Cray Research at Chippewa Falls, a story of the supercomputer, will premiere Monday at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The film was commissioned by the Chippewa Falls Museum of Industry and Technology. And joining us to talk about the film, the museum, and Cray Research Incorporated is Jim Mandelaer, who is a member of the board of directors at the museum. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's lay some foundation first and talk about Cray Research and the research computers that it produces.
Well, Cray Research actually started in 1973 when Seymour left Control Data to pursue, you know, bigger, better computing opportunities, and formed it here in Chippewa Falls. Actually, it was out in Halley where he had built a new facility to start the company in. The main product at the time was the Cray 1. When it was developed in 1976, was the most powerful computer on the face of the planet at the time. Cray Research grew from that humble beginnings of a handful of people over the years and to approximating 5,000 people employed worldwide, and was a major force in supercomputing, was the major supplier of supercomputers to a number of entities around the world, including military, governmental, and large corporations like oil companies and automobile companies.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the term supercomputer. What are some of the things a supercomputer can do that my little laptop at home can't?
Well, a supercomputer would be a machine that would be mainly built for scientific calculation, whereas your laptop at home would be a general-purpose computer. It could do all kinds of things. These big supercomputers would have a very powerful memory, a lot of memory compared to your PC, and would be running a whole lot faster than your PC. And is the kind of thing that would be, you know, orders of magnitude much larger than your, you know, capable, you know, your little PC at home.
Now, I presume there's a lot of research and development that continues to make sure that the Gray supercomputers are better than everybody else's supercomputers.
Oh, yes. This is part of the game. It's a lot. It takes a lot of effort, and it takes the effort of a, you know, big team of very specialized, you know, scientific and engineering people to produce these large machines. And it takes a lot of cooperation with a lot of vendors to make this product work.
Well, how many employees does the company have?
Well, right now, Cray has gone through several phases. You know, Cray started with a handful of employees and then grew and got bought out by Silicon Graphics and now is rebuilt as Cray Incorporated, and they have several hundred employees now in Chippewa Falls.
Are there locations elsewhere that...
Yes, the corporate headquarters for Cray Incorporated is Seattle.
Uh-huh. Now, you told me you were one of the early employees, is that right?
Yes, I was. I was fortunate enough to join the Cray One development effort and was a checkout engineer, and then took the machines into the field when they were first built.
Now, we talked a little earlier before we started this that my thought that the technology industry, I'm a person looking at it from the outside, but anyway, the technology industry often seems to be cyclical in nature or feast or famine, so to speak. Cray seems to have managed to be reasonably stable over the
years.
Well,
we've had Cray had its ups and downs. I mean, as the needs of the computing industry has changed, there's been a need to reconfigure and to restructure, and sometimes that meant that they would shrink a little bit or they would grow as the, you know, they would come up with new technology and would have continued sales.
He is Jim Mandelaire, who is a board member of the Chippewa Falls Museum of Industry and Technology, and the film we're talking about is Cray Research at Chippewa Falls, A Story of the Supercomputer. Well, let's move on to the film. What brought it about?
Well, the film is telling the story of the impact on Chippewa Falls, which was very large. Most people today remember, you know, they think back on the golden days when Cray in the 70s and the 80s was hiring and building buildings like crazy. I mean, the industrial parks in Chippewa were full of Cray buildings. And we also hired people from, you know, in the area. And so we had, you know, we got a big name, and it was a great place to work for at the time. It was a very dynamic atmosphere. Very challenging, and would bring professionals to the town. And when I'm saying professionals, I mean people with families. And so it had a huge impact on the, you know, the schools in the area, the community activities that were around. And so Cray was a huge part of Chippewa Falls back in the 60s and 70s, and continues today to be that.
Tell us about what's covered in the film. It goes, you know, it's about Cray, obviously, but there's some other industries that are mentioned as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So Seymour, it's basically about kind of Seymour's story, you know, through the years, focusing on when he was here in Chippewa Falls. He came to Chippewa Falls as a part of the Control Data days and developed a laboratory called the Chippewa Lab out in Halley and developed the big supercomputers that we know of today, the beginning of the supercomputers. And then left, but continued to stay here and built and used and made Chippewa his home base then, rather than Control Data being home based in Minneapolis.
The museum then came as kind of an offshoot of Cray
yes.
Research. How did where tell
well,
us about the history of the museum?
The museum came about as a result of the first Cray One being retired from service for several years and came back to Chippewa. And Les Davis and other managers at Cray realized that we had an important historical object here and felt that we needed to preserve the history of the computing, history of this, you know, supercomputing, and decided to put together a collection of machines, which eventually was gifted to the city of Chippewa Falls. And it was then located, the machines were located down at the old Mason Chu office building, which was the old Cray training facility, down in 21 East Grant.
So where is the museum located now?
The museum is at 21 East Grand, right near the Duncan Creek, right where the Duncan Creek and Grand Avenue meet. The museum is right there.
So there's going to be kind of a big to-do at the premiere of this show. Talk a little bit about
the program. Oh, sure. The museum is hosting the worldwide premiere of this new film, this new DVD that we produced that explains, you know, the history of, you know, Seymour Cray and the impact it had on Chippewa Falls. At that night, we are going to have several former members, employees of Cray that, you know, remember those days and are going to be talking, answering questions about the film and about Cray research and the impact it had on Chippewa Falls.
Now, the people who are going to be there, some of those have been interviewed in the film as well?
Oh, yes. That's one of the key things we want to do is that the people that really knew what was going on with Cray are the presenters in the film, talking about that.
So
they'll be there to answer questions if people have questions about, you know, their involvement and what's going on at that time.
Is there an admission charge?
No, there is no admission for that night. That's free. We're hoping to be able to sell the DVDs to the public at that time.
Now, according to a news release, though, you wouldn't turn out a donation to the museum
No, we'd be very happy to accept donations at all times. We're very, you know, we're always looking for donations.
You were one of those interviewed, as I recall.
Yes, I was.
The film. Talk a little bit about the experience of being a part of a professionally done documentary film.
Well, the thing is that it's very interesting because what you have to do is you have to go back and search your memory about the particular topics that they're going to be discussing. And going back and thinking about those days, and a lot of times for me, it was a lot of fun to go back and think about those days because a lot of us at Cray at the time felt that this was probably one of the best positions we'll ever have in our lives. And so this was really fun to, you know, think back and to come up with some of the, you know, details, you know, and put that into the film.
So when would the film begin its development process, and how long did it take to produce?
It began last year. We had a videographer that was on the board of directors. And he proposed it to us, and then over a period of several months, we had several different filming sessions and then refilming if things needed change, and wound up with a wonderful product that Rich Cornell put together for us. We really appreciate his effort in this.
Well, we've been visiting with Jim Mandelaar, who is a member of the board of directors at the Chippewa Falls Museum of Industry and Technology. The documentary film is Cray Research at Chippewa Falls, A Story of the Supercomputer. It will premiere on Monday at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The gathering is at 7 p.m. with the film at 7:30 and a question and answer session with some of the people who have been former employees at 8:30. Admission is free, but you can make a donation to the Chippewa Falls Museum of Industry and Technology. Copies of the film's DVD may be purchased at the premiere and later at the museum. Well, Jim Mandelaar, thanks so much for being with us. It sounds like a fascinating film.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
And, folks, beginning today, the Chippewa Falls Museum of Industry and Technology will be open for tours on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Good idea for the family to keep those young brains from accumulating summer rust, don't you think? Half past the hour on Spectrum West. Some Spectrum memos. Saturday is the 4th annual Stockholm Art Fair from 10 to 5 in Stockholm Village Park. Live music, food, and a whole bunch more. StockholmArtFair.com has information. Tuesday Night Blues from the Chippewa Valley Blues Society presents Steve Meyer with the True Heat Band next Tuesday, July 23rd, Owen Park Band Show in Eau Claire. Volume 1 again presents the Sounds Like Summer Concert Series at Phoenix Park in downtown Eau Claire. Tonight, Thursday night, it's Eggplant Heroes, Dames, and Kenzie Joy. Next week, the 25th, the Sue Orfield Band, Sarah Lou Richards, and the Larry Past Trio, First Notes, scheduled to drift across the confluence at about 6:30. Again this summer, the Chill on the Hill Summer Concert Series at UW River Falls, 7 p.m. next Tuesday, July 23rd. It's the St. Croix Valley Community Band. That's at the Melvin Wall Amphitheater. The Summer Sound Series Concert Series at UW Eau Claire welcomes soprano Dr. Mitra Sadapur and Dr. Barbara Young on piano. That's Sunday afternoon at 2 in Phillips Recital Hall. Next Wednesday, the 24th at 6 p.m., it's Music in the Park in downtown Durand. The Time and a Half Band from La Crosse will be there. Chill on the Hill for Kids at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls features Rita Simon and All About Belly Dancing. Next Tuesday, the 23rd at 11 a.m., information at cvca.net.
Well, fairly often news releases cross our desks from the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters in Madison. The latest mentioned an art exhibit in their gallery, and it includes an Eau Claire artist, Joe Ulm, on the faculty at UW-Eau Claire. It's another opportunity to talk more about abstract art, something she's very good at. So let's meander through that world in a conversation about the art and the artist, Jill Ulm, who teaches art foundations at UW-Eau Claire, that is collegiate level basics.
Since you deal with that, is it tough to just go back to, like, see Jane run and, you know, do the foundations? Or do you feel like you should inspire kids to do more stuff?
I find it extremely rewarding. Yeah. One, it allows me to return to my education,
okay, cool,
to some of my training. And at the same time, many students, when they come in, we do encourage them to work in a more abstract or non-representational way so that they can focus on some of the basic elements, such as color, okay, and shape and line, that when you remove the subject matter, so students don't have to worry about drawing puppies and trees,
yes,
they can isolate things like color and line and pattern.
It's very important for people listening to this to either now or eventually go to your website. Jill Ulm, JILLOLM.com is where you should go, and you'll see some of her stuff.
Mostly my website is a collection of recent, in the past probably 5 years, mm-hmm, of drawings and a few installation projects that deal with repetition and mark making and patternings. So a lot of the work will be collections of small marks to create kind of mass.
Yeah, you know, I have this written here. Even at my age, I don't yet know it all. And I learn something new every week. And you just brought up mark making. Mark making. One thinks of art as more than just that, but I guess that's kind of what you're doing. You're making marks on something. Sounds kind of Neanderthal to me, but I guess that's where it started.
Yeah, it's very primitive, very primal idea that even when you're a child,
yeah,
you know, the first time your hand can wrap around a crayon, even in a fist, the first thing you make is this mark. We make marks with our bodies all the time, footprints, spilling drinks, you know, tires skidding, you know, marks on sidewalks. So to think about using those, every line is a mark.
When you said spilling drinks, it reminded me of some of the pieces that I viewed of, mm-hmm, yours, in which you make it appear as if you threw a beanbag against the wall. That particular color of beanbag is somewhere in the vicinity underneath. That's a neat, is that what's called site specific?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the work would be drawn specifically on that wall, and at the end of the exhibition, we'd paint over it.
And you have another piece that has circles all over, and then those circles come towards you.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes the work travels off of the paper or the canvas or the picture plane, kind of through the space. I'm really interested in ideas of the differences between and the overlaps between kind of fact and fiction.
Oh,
and often,
okay,
when things come into your space, the physical space, into, mm-hmm, the room, it's on the wall, mm-hmm, it seems more real. Or if you can step on it,
mm-hmm, yeah, okay,
where looking at drawn on a piece of paper under glass on the wall looks very much like a fiction, right? Something separate from art. It's then art.
It does.
The thing to be looked at, not necessarily experienced.
Jill Ulm is with us. She's an abstract. Is it okay to identify you as an abstract artist? You're,
yep,
currently an abstract artist.
Yep.
All right. And assistant professor of painting and drawing at UW-Eau Claire. She has an exhibition at the James Watrous Gallery at the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. You also, on your website, have some words that are fun that you don't use very often. Doppelgangers, one of them. I've heard it, of course. And once one investigates that word, one finds that it's a pretty interesting topic.
Yeah. The body of work that I made for the exhibition, the Systems for Abstraction, is a new body of work I've just been working on the past probably 2 months. And within each drawing, I have two versions of the same drawing, a drawing I made on the left side. And on the right,
yes,
side, there's another frame or another drawing.
With something missing.
Yeah. And basically what I did is I looked and I tried to pull some kind of data or some kind of information from my own drawing. Often what you get on the other side is a version. I also like the word surrogate. I've always just liked the word doppelganger even to say.
Me too.
But thinking about finding your or seeing a version of something else that's not the same, but that it also has a very kind of mythic and or mystical approach to it as well, that to see your personal doppelganger would either have a positive or a negative effect on your life.
Yes.
So connecting kind of facts and fiction. So there's still stories attached to it, so that the marks I make are often derived from systems of organization and categorization, graphing, yet kind of reusing them and interpreting to give them back some fiction, some magic, some storytelling, some possibility to be something more.
I ask this of artists all the time. The question is, how do you know when you're finished with a piece of art? These things are so busy. How do you know that it's time to stop making marks?
It's a difficult question, and it's a difficult thing to know as an artist yourself.
But you do know it.
Yes.
You do.
And sometimes I go too far, and those drawings don't make it. They end up in the trash can or the flat file.
You know you're too far.
I can see it afterwards often. Or sometimes you stop a little short. I often work on a group of works at one time so that I can pause and step away and kind of come back to a work. I can look at it for at least a few days, if not a couple of weeks, and see if the drawing needs some more work. I also found for me, there's a point where it starts to really become work, the details, the nuance, coming back, stepping away from the work and really looking at it with a critical eye and saying, how does this work as a drawing fundamentally, you know, balance? And when that happens, I usually know it's about to be done once I make those decisions.
Now, your pieces all have names. Do they start out in your head as a name, or do you name it after it's finished?
I name them after they're finished.
So they become something.
Yeah. I often don't know what they're going to be. I have ideas, preliminary ideas and sketches. And as I work through, I really embrace mistakes and errors and think about how they could create something new, could trigger me to make a connection I didn't see before. I rarely know what the end product's going to look like when I begin. But I often listen to the radio, audiobooks, those types of things while I'm working. And sometimes I find language that kind of connects to what I'm doing. And so I usually have a notebook or a sketchbook that I collect words and ideas that I could see relating to my work. And then at the end, go back and use titles, one, to help maybe help direct viewers, but without revealing or attaching something to the work that's too specific.
You use doppelganger and surrogate to describe your work. Then you use distraction and diversion as well. That gets into the naming end of it. Mm-hmm. Do you name it by something that you see? I mean, obviously, when people just do, you know, impressionistic work or naturalist work, it's easy to say, this is called serenity. And it seems to me, obviously, in abstract art, naming is tougher.
I find it difficult. Mm-hmm. I also enjoy it. Finding ways to not have them all be Untitled 1, Untitled 2. To help provide another context for the work that maybe I've seen, and I usually do title after stepping back, looking at the work. And then, sometimes it has to do with my state of mind and thinking about distractions and diversions. That there is a part of my work that, although is pulled from scientific or quantitative systems, it's very much intuitive. It's there's a part that they're just maybe big doodles. And so sometimes it is my own distraction. And I believe that's something that's very real for people. We all have those moments where you're working on one thing, yet you're listening to the conversation that someone else is having, and they combine and they make something new. That's kind of what my drawings are for me. It's those distractions. That doesn't have to be a negative. They can create a new situation you never anticipated.
You brought up the two words puppies and trees before. Are there puppies and trees in your work?
No, there are no puppies and
you
trees
can't,
in my
you
work.
You can't find them anywhere.
Maybe if you looked hard enough.
I didn't see any puppies or
trees.
Yeah,
you probably will not.
I didn't see any at all. How early as an instructor do you encourage a student to go off on tangents? Or can you, as an instructor of foundations?
I think we encourage it fairly soon in someone's academic career. I think that's where a lot of creativity really stems from. Mm-hmm. Embracing your curiosities. Right, allowing yourself to think of more possibilities, other solutions to problems than maybe your peers, or thinking about how you can exploit the assignment at hand instead of just producing a replica of something by the instructor. I think the tough part is then to teach a student how to deal with those, how to look at their distractions or their diversions and look back critically and think about what needs to be edited, controlled. Now that you've experimented, do you need to remake, redo using some of the information that you just discovered?
With art being such a broad perspective, how can you possibly grade a student on what they're doing? they might just be expressing themselves in a different way. Can you only grade on either following instructions or not following instructions? Or how do you grade budding artists?
It is difficult, but we do have kind of systems and rubrics of how to determine whether a work is good. There are kind of rules, compositional rules.
Does this look like a puppy?
If that was the assignment, okay. You know, did you do that? You know, we encourage our students to do lots of sketching. Mm-hmm. They write for us. And they pass that in with the final project. Most of our classes are small enough that we can speak with students one-on-one while they're making their work. And we can see if they've worked through a variety of solutions or did they just use the first solution that popped into their head. And then there are the very technical components to grading work. Did it meet the specific project outcome? Did you learn these very specific skills mm-hmm. And approaches?
I read a definition that said abstract synthesizes and communicates information.
For me, I think that's true. I think of it more as asking the viewer questions.
Okay.
Not necessarily telling them a specific narrative, but allowing the viewer to participate in the viewing experience. To be able to say, what is that? Why is that like that? Allows the viewer to have some power, to be involved in that experience. So I'm not telling you a story. Mm-hmm. I'm asking you to have a conversation with the work, with me. And I think that's where meanings develop, and there can be multiple meanings and interpretations. It allows the viewer to pull from their own experiences and lives and skill sets and knowledge sets.
Yeah, I think I've asked one other person this before, and I remember the answer, I believe. Is there joy as an artist in seeing people interpret your art as many different things? I remember one answer saying, yeah, you know, there's this wonderful feeling when someone interprets it in a way that I never even thought of.
I find it wonderful. It's mm-hmm. one of the most rewarding aspects, I think, of working this way, at least for me. Occasionally, you get some responses that surprise you in maybe a less positive way. But knowing that your work is challenging people, it's exciting people, they get to participate. It also is really interesting to see the range, even between ages. You know, how a young child comes at it. They will often see a puppy or a tree. I get a lot of mathematicians and hard natural scientists who look at my work and feel like there's components of what they do in there.
Wow.
They can find those personal attractions or connections to the work. And then that can trigger me to do often more research and take some of those ideas into other works.
Jill Olm, OLM.com, is where you can see a lot of Jill's work. Thanks very much for being with us. Thanks for the artists that you're producing. Teaching, you love it?
I do.
You do?
I find it incredibly rewarding.
Could you just be an artist without teaching, do you think?
Yes.
Could you be a teacher without being an artist?
No.
Yeah. The mark of a good artist is knowing that your marks are making people think. Again, the website is Jill Olm, OLM.com. And the Madison exhibit is up through August 25th. This is Spectrum West.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Ken Vance Audi, featuring the refreshed 2013 Audi Q5, a compact luxury SUV with the new option of a supercharged V6. More at kenvance.com.
Support also comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering full real estate services from listing to selling properties. Current listings, mortgage calculator, and other information is online at wisconsinrealty.org.
So glad you could join us on this, our second Thursday morning edition of Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Behind me, the rhythm of Mr. Babatunde Lee. The Phipps Center for the Arts is holding a drum camp, Rhythms of the African Diaspora, beginning Monday, and the instructor is the well-known multiple percussionist Babatunde Lee, a musical diplomat and collaborator who's been around the block, working with artists of very notable renown. He now lives in Menominee, Wisconsin, joining his wife, Dr. Virginia Lee, a UW Stout professor who teaches critical issues in multicultural education. She's also co-founder of their Educultural Foundation. From roots in New York and New Jersey, then all the way across to the Bay Area of California, now in the Midwest, Tunde, as he signs his emails, steadfastly believes in the power of music for good, for transformation, for understanding, for you, and for me. I believe we could fill a whole hour of Spectrum West if we simply mixed your experience and my curiosity. But we don't have that amount of time, so I'm just going to try to hit on some interesting points for people. You started out east, and then you decided to go all the way across the country over to the Bay Area. You can drop some pretty impressive names in people with whom you have collaborated. My curiosity wants to know the origin of your first name.
Have you ever heard of Babatunde Olatunji? Well, he was an African percussionist. In fact, his recording, Drums of Passion, was the first hi-fi recording. I saw him in 1959. I was 11 years old, and I was already a drummer in the drum line, but marching for parades and stuff back then. When I saw him, I always loved drums and everything, and he just wiped me out. I mean, he literally changed my name. Freudian slip. Changed my whole perspective. He let me know that I'm a drummer, and that's what I've been wanting to do and trying to do since 1959. It was because of him. His troupe. He's Nigerian. His name means father returns, and you only get that when you've been born posthumously to your father or grandfather. And I was born posthumously to my grandfather. It means the spirit of them is coming back through you. And on the greater and more generally, it means the spirit of the ancestors are coming back through you. That was a name that I got from, you know, from the inspiration that he gave to me.
And you drum literally everything, don't you?
Well, I mean, so many drums, too little time.
Yeah, all different sizes.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's what I teach. I teach a course called Rhythms of the African Diaspora, and I teach a number of African drumming traditions.
Okay. You're a widely traveled gentleman. Do you still do that? Do you still go around places and make and record music and network and jam with other people?
That is my life. You said exactly right. You know, as well as teaching. Last thing I did out in California, I did the Playboy Jazz Festival playing with Bill Cosby's All-Star Band. I go all over. My band, we just appeared at the Kutztown University in Pennsylvania, and then at Artist Quarter, the 26th and 27th, coming up this month of July. I got a gig coming up at Phipps in Hudson, the 22nd of September. Yeah, basically, I'm always, you know, looking to do and a good gig and travel and do what I do.
We are talking with Babatunde Lee. He's a percussionist, very well known, very well traveled, and he is not only a tutor, but he sort of teaches us all about life. I read that you believe, and I think rightly so, that music opens people to the deepest experiences of life. I saw music is listed as a resource. Do you think music is a natural resource?
Yeah, by all means, it is. It comes straight from the mind, body, and spirit of human beings. And it takes myriad positions and trajectories. That's why you have jazz, and you have classical, and you have what's happening in India, the ragas, and what's happening in China. I mean, yeah, and all people create and partake of music. Mm-hmm. And it's the one language that people quickly understand.
Is drumming and rhythm the most primal form of music that we have?
Well, what do you mean by primal?
Well, the beginning. Is that what you believe, that we as evolving species first found to be intriguing? And then we added notes, and then we added humming and singing.
Well, I think we hummed and sang first.
But drums were at one time a form of communication, and probably still are in a different level, huh?
Yeah, most definitely. They have a drum called the talking drum in Nigeria that speaks the Yoruba language.
You also have, from what I read, high expectations for your music. You believe that music empowers people to look within, become agents of peace and change, which I think is wherein I got the line, you have high expectations for your music. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, that's very fair. I mean, I believe that music does open you up. But the thing is, what one has to remember is it opens you up, but it doesn't put inside you the necessary thing. With our nonprofit, we have a program called Concerts and Conversations.
Yeah.
We play music, and also we have conversations on different issues. that are in the community or in a educational facility or anything that anybody is dealing with. Then the music opens you up and allows you to, you know, discuss and have dialogue on different issues better than if you just try to do it straight on. Trying to do it just straight on, we usually fail miserably. All we have to do is look around and see how we have failed in communication and understanding the different and deeper meanings of life, and understanding, most importantly, how as humankind we are all connected. That's like the polyrhythms, you know. We are all connected. The sooner we understand that, the quicker we can maybe evolve into something that is not going to be killing and hurting and misusing and abusing each other.
Yeah, it seems as if, I mean, and I believe it's obviously true of you, but seems as if we should just allow music to speak for us more often. I mean, you, the way it looks to me, do that very sincerely. You did a tribute to Leon Thomas. You really had a kind of a life quest to say, you know, someday I'm going to figure out how to pay tribute to this man. And then I read a quote by Carlos Santana, and within it, he called you and your friends daring musical cohorts. I love the word daring when it comes to music. Do you feel like you're daring when you're making music?
Yeah, well, you know, it's, I feel like I'm daring when I wake up in the morning. So, yeah, I guess that would fit because, you know, sometimes you just got to lean into the wind, you know, and that doing this is more than a notion. Sometimes you just have to really stick with it, you know, because it's not always a picnic. You know, you have to have a conviction and a very strong conviction. And I know that music is who I am, and drumming is who I am, and for better or worse. And we can continue to do that, and as once was said, by any means necessary.
Yeah, it seems like for a lot of people, they always use the term, we always use the term, making music. And for many people, that's enough for them, is to just make music. Make music to be popular, make music to sell. You depend on music to be a real strong and sincere voice.
Yes, I can agree with that statement, you know, because to me, I know it is that important in our lives. But the thing also that I do know is that's just not me. And people who approach it on different levels is only because of their own personal experience. Because what is my contention is that this level of appreciation and playing music and making music can be with everybody, with all humankind, and we can partake of it. And I think that's where I'm trying to point people in that direction. We need to open ourselves up to the music because music is transcendental. It can move you from one place to another. And it also, it brings about the reality of the unseen and make that, you know, palpable. Music has, you know, a lot of roads into a lot of different places. In fact, from playing jazz, and I have played with some very brilliant musicians, it's also my contention that music is the precursor to mental telepathy.
Oh, wow.
I think that needs to be studied, what musicians do with each other.
It's an interesting phenomenon when everybody just seems to follow each other and sort of know where each other is going.
Right, yeah. You know, I mean, that's a connection.
That's cool. Do you try to instill the depth that we were just talking about within young people when you mentor them, or is it just enough to watch them having fun?
Well, you know, water seeks its own level, so I'm always trying to do that to the degree that I can with whoever I'm doing it with. But, you know, the playing of the music, and especially if I'm there for more than one day or something, you know, or if I, like, I'm teaching a class and a course or residency, the plot always thickens as we go along.
Well, Babatunde Lee, I appreciate you spending time with me. It's been just an amazing pleasure for me to just discover that you are in our midst. Keep in touch with us here at Spectrum West, because this is what we're all about. We're about the arts and music and culture and humanities, and it sounds as if you touch each one of those on very strong and continuous levels.
Right. Well, thank you very much, and I hope to make more inroads, and hope everybody is as positive about discovering me as you have been. because I'm looking to do residencies and teaching positions, as well as concerts and festivals.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Alan.
Take care.
You too.
A little bit of the band in the background. So why not sign your kid up for the drum camp? It starts Monday at the Phipps in Hudson. I'll bet you they can slip him or her in. Remember, he or she will get a whole lot more than just technique. And remember, the band is at the Artists' Quarter. That is in St. Paul on July 26th and 27th.
What's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Great River Road Theater is presenting The King and I through Sunday in the Prescott City Park. The one-man show Meet Mr. Longfellow will play Saturday at the Northern Lake Center for the Arts in Amory. The Producers runs through August 4th at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The Northern Star Theater Company of Rice Lake is presenting The Bikinis through Sunday. And Annie is on stage at the Red Barn Theater in Rice Lake through Saturday. The Eau Claire Children's Theater is presenting The Glass Slipper through Friday at the Oxford Theater. Bingo the Musical is playing at Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through August 25th. Crazy for You and The Foreigner are playing at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. Crazy for You will run through August 18th, The Foreigner through August 25th. And the Youth and Family Theater Series at the Festival Theater will present A Midsummer Night's Dream beginning Saturday and continuing through August 8th. William Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, King Henry V, and Macbeth are playing in repertory through August 3rd at the Great River Shakespeare Festival in Winona. Peter Pan and Tink will play for groups through August 2nd at the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. And the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson is playing Always Patsy Cline. The show will run Fridays and Saturdays through August 10th. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
I'm Al Ross. And if you can, come on back for another hour of what we're up to in West Wisconsin next Thursday morning on Spectrum West. See you then. Thanks.